Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we're talking about rosé.
Yes, rosé, because it's prime rosé time.
It is. It's the summer is heating up.
Yes.
The weather, in fact, is warmer.
Depending on where you are.
Yes. But goodness.
Yeah, we can't forget.
Oh, that means that Christmas rosés are totally a thing in some parts of the world. That's delightful.
I would enjoy a Christmas rosé. Something else I would enjoy is to make a lot of puns, which I wrote down in here.
Oh, you did?
But I'm not going to make them because they might be the title choice.
Oh, okay.
So you're just going to, sorry, listeners, but you're just going to have to fill in the blank for yourself there.
Know that Annie is sitting on a bunch of puns.
Yes, a mountain
of puns.
But yeah, speaking of rosé time, National Rosé Day here in the U.S. is June 10th.
Yes, it is the second Saturday of every June.
Ooh, mm-hmm. So it's fast approaching as we record this.
Uh-huh. And rosé wine, by the way, just in case that wasn't
clear.
Anyway, I will say that I am an absolute sucker for, like, really brute sparkling rosé.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorite ways to feel like I'm treating myself or, you know, whoever I'm shopping for something nice. Like, you know, $14 a bottle. Ooh. And I'm also a sucker for frosés, but
yes.
That is a different vibe.
Yes, very different vibe. We will be touching on that. I'm pretty new to rosé, but I also enjoy a brut sparkling rosé. But this brings us to our question.
Yes.
Rosé. What is it?
Well, rosé is a type of wine that's pink or, you know, sort of rosy.
Sort of, yeah.
Sort of. It can be made a number of ways, but the traditional method is to, quick winemaking 101. You grow some grapes, yeah? You harvest those grapes, squish them to extract their juice. I'm using all the technical terms here. Depending on what kind of wine you're making, you might separate the juice from the skins immediately because the longer you let the juice rest on the skins, the more color and flavor that the juice will absorb. From those skins and seeds and other stuff, but sure. This is also known as maceration, letting the juice and the stuff sit together. So if you're, making a white wine from grapes that have pale flesh and dark red skins, you want to get those skins out of there immediately. With a rosé, you most likely let the juice macerate a while, like 2 to 48 hours, but not as long as you would do for a wine that you want to be truly, truly red.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Very traditionally, rosé wine grapes are harvested on the early side of ripeness before too much sugar has developed in the grapes, and they're collected at night when temperatures are cooler so that the human in charge of fermenting the wine has more precise control over that fermentation, which requires the application of heat, but for rosés, like, you don't want to use, like, too much heat.
Mm.
Yeah. You can also just blend red and white grape juices or even red and white wines that have already been through the fermentation process, but these methods will give you a different product, which is sometimes looked down upon.
Looked down upon, you say?
By professional winemakers.
No, professional winemakers never look down upon anyone. Scandal.
They have zero opinions about their product.
Yes.
And the methods.
No judgment thereby. In that community.
No, fair judgment. I'm judgmental, too. I don't know if you guys had ever noticed that.
Lauren, so, I don't think that's true. Tell me about your bagel opinions again. No. Different episode. You can see our bagel episode for that.
And speaking of differing opinions, like red and white wines, rosés can have differing flavors. Anywhere from dry to sweet, from fresh or puckery to mellow or rich. And, you know, different wines for different palates. But there are some common characteristics because macerating grape juice for different periods of time will give you different compounds in the juice, which will develop into more different compounds as you ferment the wine, and then even more other different ones depending on aging process. Rosés tend, though, to be bright, a little fruity, and crisp.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Back in 2013, the INRA, that's a French institute, Institut National de la Recherche Agronomique, yeah, sort of, kind of, cool. It's an agricultural research institute in France, along with the Centre de Rosé and the French Vine and Wine Institute. Oh, goodness, and there's more words after that. Anyway, bunch of groups published the results of their survey of 298 rosé wines from 21 different countries. Their purpose here was to analyze the phenolic composition of these wines, phenolic compounds being a whole huge group of stuff in plants that are responsible for many of plants' colors and flavors. They're trying to make sense of how different grapes and different production methods lead to different flavors and colors in the finished wine. And it's a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff, they say.
It is. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, research has shown that the pink color of rosé is the most important factor to consumers of rosé, which is just wild to me. A researcher studying all of this out of Washington State University said that getting the perfect color and flavor, even if that does come in second, is hard because the color fades during fermentation and then darkens in the bottle. He said that you might lose 60 to 70% of the initial color that you started out with when you first pressed the grapes.
Mm. That doesn't surprise me, the importance of the color. My ex-boyfriend once bought a wine just because it was blue. You know?
Was it flavored like blue?
It kind of was. It was sweet. It was too sweet.
Okay.
That was my judgment. I'm very bad at describing flavors, but too sweet.
Too sweet. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But avoid it was blue.
Perhaps avoid blue wine.
Maybe it was just it, that one. But,
was it like Romulan blue or like?
It was, yes.
Okay.
And he's a big Star Trek fan.
Oh.
So it was all.
Well.
Coming together. There was also a Klingon wine. This was not a Star Trek party. This was just all there. These are the parties I attend.
Accidental themes.
Yes.
Yeah,
oh.
I like them.
Mm-hmm.
France, which does produce the most rosé worldwide, some 27% of the global supply, has a color chart. They call it a nuancier for rosés from the primary production region, Provence. And these colors range from like the palest ballet slipper pink to coral to like a good ruby. And the Council of Wines of Provence has tracked consumer preference by shade of color.
Oh my goodness.
They say that it ranges from most popular to least popular. Peach, melon, mango, pomelo, sort of like pink grapefruit, mandarin, and red currant.
Oh my. I love it. It's silly, but I love it. Uh-huh. Also, Council of Wines.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I think there's more on them later.
Okay. Nutrition.
Drink responsibly.
Yep. There you go. Numbers. The biggest producer by volume is France, followed by Spain, Rosado, Italy, Rosato, and then the United States.
It is made all over, though. Argentina, Chile, South Africa, Russia, Germany, places that make wine, basically.
Yeah.
France actually drinks more than it makes. They are a net importer, as is Germany. And as of 2013, around the world, rosés accounted for some 9% of all the wine produced. And how much wine is that? You ask, perhaps?
I do.
24.1 million hectoliters of rosé. A hectoliter being 100 liters. So a lot.
Yeah.
2.4 billion liters is a lot.
I agree.
I think I did the math. It came out to 634 million gallons. Not that we usually consume wine in gallons, but just to give you a rough idea.
Speak for yourself, Lauren. Just kidding. Just kidding. Drink responsibly.
Drink responsibly.
Mm-hmm. In 2013, the U.S. imported 4 million cases of Provençal rosé, 25 times more than a decade earlier in 2003. That year, Americans drank 279.4 million liters.
Whew.
Some numbers indicate rosé is one of the fastest growing markets for 2 years in a row from 2017. And also from 2017, sales went up 53% in the U.S., $258 million. The Washington Post says we are at peak pink.
Peak pink.
That is hard to say.
It is.
Peak pink. Stop and smell the rosé was another headline I enjoyed. hashtag rosé all day. It's an Instagram sensation. Hashtag yes way rosé. It's millennial pink, which is like the in color. There are articles about it. You know this color. You've seen it.
Everywhere.
It's the color of shorts.
Yeah.
It's just
everything everywhere. Is in millennial pink now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's equally enjoyed by men and women, sometimes jokingly called rosé. The label of the Charles and Charles rosé leads, yes, you can drink rosé and still be badass.
You know, it's true.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the allure is that it seems like a day drinking summer outdoors wine.
It's lighter. I mean, it is a little bit lighter in alcohol content. It's only usually like a 10% as opposed to like a 14 to 17 for a lot of other wines.
Mm-hmm. It is more popular among the younger set and in coastal cities. NYC, New York City, drinks a quarter of imported rosé.
Oh, goodness.
It's also generally economical. And there are all those rosé-themed products, shirts, deodorants, floats for the pool, festivals.
There is a pop-up rosé mansion in New York City in the summer. I think this is their second year running. Taste 8 different wines as you make your way through a labyrinth of science, history, and wine culture. There's 14 rooms. You can visit Cleopatra's Palace, a 1960s-themed acid test, our vintage airline lounge, and more. I don't know if that's all one thing or different ones. I couldn't really tell.
I love it.
The Champagne Disco Ball Pit will be back.
Disco Ball Pit?
Introducing Rosé Land, the greatest wine-themed playground on the planet.
Wine-themed playground?
Yeah, so, you know.
Well.
Go and Instagram it. That's what they really want you to do.
I would, if I was there, I would go. Listeners, if you go or have been, please let us know. And yeah, back to Froze for a second. I know a year or so ago, the building our studio is located in tried to get the Guinness World Record for largest Froze toast, because you can get Froze up on the roof.
Yeah, yeah. We're one of those posh, like live, work, play kind of places.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think it happened because I signed up, you know, clearly.
And he was like, yes.
Yes. And then I never heard back.
Oh.
Maybe they didn't invite me.
Oh, no.
Oh, that can't be true. That can't be it.
Clearly not.
But 2016 was the year of the Froze, I read. And I also read somewhere that it's like a popular joke that it's the dating drink of white people.
Yeah. I will put in here that a Forbes article I read started with, you know how they have like key tweetable points at the top of some of these news sites now? And one of theirs was, many rosés are wines of quality, comma, made by winemakers of skill and terroir of distinction.
So rosé is... Don't look down on rosé.
Yeah,
it can't be good.
It was the key point.
Well.
Important takeaway.
It's the takeaway of this episode.
It is.
But we have other takeaways. We have more than one takeaway.
We do, as we frequently do, I hope. Goodness my gracious. Oh. Oh. we've got some history for you, including some about white Zinfandel.
No.
But first, we've got a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Many of the first recorded wines were, in fact, rosés.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about that in our very first episode on sparkling wine.
Oh,
we were so young. So innocent. Oh. Anyway, a lot of early wines were watered down blends of white and red grapes. The Greeks viewed it as civilized. But as usual, these weren't exactly the rosés that we are used to today. They were fairly off dry. At the time, wine wasn't macerated as long as it is today, so it rarely developed that deep red color. A fun myth goes that Amphictyon, Pyrrha, and Deucalion's son cut red wine with water to keep the arguing to a minimum.
Clever.
Yes. Ancient Greeks did believe for a time that drinking pure wine was sinful and would lead to murder and other crimes. This might go back to the legend of the Battle of Lapith with the Centaurs. Centaurs attending a wedding feast of the Lapith tribe got drunk, drinking straight wine, and started attacking the other guests.
Oh, no.
The story goes that uncut wine drove Spartan King Clominus to insanity and eventually suicide. A famous Greek traveler, Pausanias, wrote about Brennus, the leader of the Gallic tribe. Brennus's wounds left him no hope. They say out of fear of his countrymen and even more out of the shame as the cause of all their sufferings in Greece, he died deliberately by drinking unmixed wine.
Dang.
I know.
What a way to go.
Indeed. When the Phoenicians arrived in what is now Marseille, France, in 6th century BCE, they brought with them grapevines. The red and white grapes were blended together to make a pinkish wine. They were all the rage in the Mediterranean, and word spread about the, quote, pleasant pink wines from Marseille. The Romans knew all about them when they arrived in Provence, and that the trade of rosés expanded after that.
Yes, and this all means that rosé has been a Provence, France thing for like 2,600 years.
Yep.
Love it.
towards the middle of 100 CE, the Romans popularized darker red wine. Mm-hmm. During the Middle Ages, the Bordeaux region produced a nowadays mostly extinct dark red rosé called claret, or they would have called it claret. At the time, this was the most exported wine to England. Once the 18th century rolled around, the British moved on to darker reds, clarets, and that became their wine of choice. In part of Austria, the Celts found and fell for a native grape called Rabiat Perle, or Rabid Pearls.
Hmm.
They were most likely called this because they fermented on the vine and got you good and drunk. It was commonly understood to cause high blood pressure, aggression, and even gout.
Good on them. That's some solid health science right there.
Solid health science.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the 1700s that humans, and maybe specifically a human whose name you might recognize, Dom Pérignon, figured out the technology and methodology for producing white wines from red grapes. So until then, probably like a bunch of wines were pink.
Yes. Moving on to the 19th century, light wines in the process of producing them had made its way to California. The first documented rosé out of California was the 1869 Zinfandel grape rosé from El Pinal Winery. And moving into the 20th century, tourism to the Provence region, aka Rosé Central, brought it back into popular culture in Europe and inspired Italy and Spain to start making their own. In 1961, Julia Child said you can serve rosé with anything.
And I believe her.
I do too.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The seeds of rosé's popularity in the United States were planted in the 1970s with the notorious White Zinfandel. Thunder crack.
AC/DC song.
Yeah.
Here.
So what happened was, the owners of Sutter Home are the Trinchero family. And in 1972, they were a mid-sized winery in California, and one Bob Trinchero was actually looking to make a darker, richer Zinfandel wine. So to do this, after squishing their grapes, they drained off some of the juice right away with the hopes that the remaining juice would pick up a heavier dose of the color and flavor from the skins. This is a technique called saigné, which means bleeding in French. And it developed centuries ago in response to the greater popularity of dark reds. But the thing about saigné is that it leaves you with this, like, mostly white juice left over as a byproduct. So as folks presented with this surplus juice have dang near always done, the Trinchero family went on and fermented it into a dry wine that they called White Zinfandel. But
oh no!
Then, in 1975,
I can't take it anymore. The drama is too much. No. Okay, in 1975, Sutter Home ran into a problem with stuck fermentation. This is a situation when the sugar doesn't all the way convert to alcohol, leaving you with a slightly sweet wine.
Yeah, like kind of sweet, kind of pinker, and with less alcohol content than a normal wine. And what's going on here is that for some reason, the yeast all dies off before they finish eating all that sugar and pooping alcohol. It happens sometimes.
Mm-hmm. They could have tossed it, but they wisely chose to sell it as Sutter Home White Zinfandel, and it was a hit and the start of the blush wine category here in America. This 1970s blush wine U.S. explosion was also in part because of the high demand for white wine in California that led to a shortage of white grapes. So wineries made white wine out of red grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Also, the Sutter Home White Zinfandel experiment was called Œil de Perdrix, Eye of the Partridge. This phrase originated in France's Champagne region and referred to the pink color of the eyes of a dying partridge.
Gosh, that's goth.
Right?
Love it.
Mm-hmm. Allegedly, at one time, this was one of the most popular glasses of wine in the world.
Mm-hmm.
All over the U.S. in the 80s, people were ordering or buying White Zinfandel. This actually came up in one of our interviews with a former bartender in New Orleans about how it changed the bar scene. And it opened like it was a, what do they call that? Gateway wine.
Yeah. As of 1987, Sutter Home's White Zin was the most popular wine in the United States. They were selling 25,000 cases per year in 81. By 87, they were selling over 4.5 million cases per year. In 1994, Wine Spectator magazine gave Bob a sort of like midlife achievement award for, quote, having introduced more Americans to wine on the table than anyone in history.
Wow.
Wow. Love it.
Well, the white Zin might have achieved popularity. It was sometimes called a gateway wine, like I said, but it suffered a backlash.
Oh, yeah.
It was dismissed and looked down upon by sommeliers and, quote, serious wine drinkers during the 90s. It was seen as the cheap box wine that their moms drank. Tacky.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. In 1992, Wolfer Estate produced their first rosé in Long Island called Hampton's Gatorade. 82 cases. Nowadays, they produce 22,000 cases, and they're running, quote, dangerously low.
Meanwhile, mm-hmm. back in France, I put more French in here, heck. The Centre de Recherche et d'Expérimentation sur la Vin Rosé, maybe? Yeah, sure. That was founded in 1999. In English, that's the Center for Rosé Research, which I think loses something in translation, which is why even though my French accent is terrible, I kind of wanted to attempt saying it. Anyway, this Center for Rosé Research was sort of the culmination of a whole decade or so of increasing seriousness about rosés in France. No longer just a byproduct or an afterthought, what with all of the American attention to blushes, wineries in France were starting to focus specifically on making, like, really decent rosés. A whole industry of technology for rosés sprung up. Refrigeration systems to control the temperature, stainless steel tanks to prevent unwanted flavors from creeping in. Stainless steel keeps wines tasting crisp and fresh, whereas wood can add all kinds of rich, buttery, or vanilla-y notes that you might not want.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the 2000s when beach resorts, hotels, destinations started serving rosé as kind of a beach wine, kind of that day wine we were talking about earlier, that American fascination with it really took off. And I read somewhere, too, that it had to do with kind of a renewed fascination with France.
Mm-hmm.
Social media helped, too. For instance, the Fat Jew, some of you may have heard of him, caught the attention of social media at large when he went around New York City in a salmon-colored car, a giant wine bottle, rosé bottle, and a gospel choir belting out Lady Gaga's Just Dance on National Rosé Day. It was a whole thing. Celebrities also helped elevate rosé's standing. Jay-Z rapped about rosé in his 2006 song 30-something as a diss on rappers who weren't hip, weren't with the times. the lyric was, y'all drink Dom, but not rosé.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Brangelina, Brad Pitt, and Angelina Jolie used to have a wine from their estate, Miraval. I'm not sure if it still exists since they're not together anymore. It probably does, but one of the Kardashians Snapchatted a 40 of rosé. I've been told it was not Kim because she doesn't drink.
Oh.
I don't know much about the Kardashians.
Me neither. I can't help you there.
Well, alas.
But a wine expert working with JetBlue on their drink menu recently declared rosé to be the best in-flight wine.
Really?
In the air, that the dryness and the pressure of the cabin makes you experience wines and all flavors and smells differently than you would here on the ground. Key there is that aromas dissipate really quickly. So everything you love about like a rich, heavy red on the ground will taste really flat in the air. However, one Kelsey McKinney, writing for GQ, pointed out, quote, ultimately, though, the differences in the sky aren't drastic enough to make you spit take. If you hate rosé, for example, being in a giant metal tube hurtling through the air at hundreds of miles per hour is not going to suddenly make you like it.
Yes, I think that is accurate.
And I just found that to be a very wise quote.
Very wise indeed.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, these days, even that maligned white Zin category is making a comeback. I think a lot of winemakers are doing dry versions now and using the name to like play on nostalgia and to feature the cool flavors that you get from Zinfandel grapes, but like maybe mostly the nostalgia thing. Wines labeled white Zinfandel sell something like 10 million cases per year in the United States, perhaps as much as 10% of all wine sold here.
Wow. The white Zin.
I love it.
So great. I have to say, it does feel pretty new to me. So I guess I got caught up in this whole millennial pink phenomenon.
Yeah. I've been seeing more of them. I've definitely been buying more of them. But I feel like for the first time within the past maybe 5 years, I started seeing bottles of dry rosés as opposed to, because I don't really like a sweet wine.
I don't either. And I have noticed, because I asked super producer Andrew and I asked somebody else who works here in the office what their thoughts on rosé were. And they're like, well, we don't like sweet wines. I'm like, well, I don't either. But, you know, there's more options now. Mm-hmm.
The first time that I ever liked a rosé was when we were doing interviews for that very first episode. It was then Food Stuff. We were out at a local winery, Three Sisters.
Yep.
Yeah, up in Dahlonega. And they served us a sparkling rosé, I believe. And I was like, I don't hate this. This is pleasant.
Nice, dry, crisp.
Yeah.
Delightful. Mm-hmm. And it was cold at the time.
It was. Oh, it was chilly that day.
So imagine. We had it this summer.
Ooh.
Plans. Plans.
Yes.
Further research. So that's about what we have to say on rosé.
It is.
But we do have a little bit more for you.
But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Listener Mail.
I was trying to go for brosé. But then I almost said listener rosé, which is, Laura knows, is a frequent blooper I make.
Where
I don't say listener mail, but I say the topic of the episode.
Yeah.
So there was a moment of panic, but it all worked out.
It did.
It's all fine.
We're doing just okay.
Kathleen wrote, I just finished the Pavlova episode, and it reminded me of an episode of The Great British Baking Show. In each episode of the show, there is a technical challenge where contestants are given a stripped-down recipe, i.e. missing some information or with minimal instructions.
Oh, it always makes me so nervous.
Just reading about it makes me nervous. Most of the time, the technical challenge recipe is an obscure dish that the contestants are unlikely to be familiar with. In one episode, contestants were given a recipe for a vegan pavlova that used chickpea juice instead of egg whites. It was hilarious and fascinating to watch the confused contestants draining chickpea juice into the bowls of their electric mixers and watching anxiously to see if the juice would begin to resemble whipped egg whites. And it did.
Aww.
The end results looked delicious and, according to the judges, had the texture and taste of meringue. I haven't tried it yet, but I wonder if chickpea juice could be used to make vegan angel food cake and other desserts that typically require egg whites.
Oh.
I have done this before.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's fascinating. I'd love to know the science behind it. But, yeah, it something happens. Something happens. And then you're like, oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Okay.
This is similar to what I normally use. Future research,
absolutely. Indeed. Chickpea episode forthcoming. Chrissy wrote, back in the 80s, due to a multitude of car accidents, the administration decided that prom was no longer going to be held at other venues, and it would be at the school, with the hopes that drinking and driving would be curbed. The juniors began choosing themes for prom and spent the week leading up to the event decorating the gym as a gift to the seniors. Themes like Under the Sea, Hollywood, or Alice in Wonderland were some of them. The gym really transformed, and it didn't feel like prom at the school at all. Since prom was now on campus, people in town started coming to watch the students arrive, and thus, a red carpet was born. Students would come in cool cars, bikes, trolleys, their father's bakery's bread truck, and throw rolls and flour, but never limos or party buses. This tradition still continues today. Now, here's where it connects. Our town is a small seaside community of about 15,000 between Boston and Cape Cod. We're known for our oysters, shout out to Island Creek, gorgeous beaches, great schools, and the occasional celebrity neighbor. Well, some of our local celebrities just happen to be the Farley brothers. Yes, the directors of Dumb and Dumber. Bobby still lives in town. Peter is on the West Coast. So back to prom and arriving in style. What did two couples end up arriving in? The Muttmobile! And to top it off, they're wearing baby blue and orange tuxes, just like the movie.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. That is a different experience than my prom, but that sounds fun. Oh.
Yes, that sounds more fun than my prom. Apologies, prom.
Yeah, no apologies to my prom.
Oh.
But the Muttmobile, we mentioned in our food vehicles episode briefly.
We did.
Scott alluded to it being a documentary, which of course it is.
Right.
Of course.
Well, I mean, clearly the vehicle is real, so the rest of it must be accurate as well.
That's how it works. That is how it works.
Absolutely how it works.
Thanks to both of them for writing in. Before we close out, two quick announcements. One, thanks to the people who wrote in about my funny, well, not funny, but it's funny to me, confusion of names of Game of Thrones, because I did it in the very episode where I mixed up Missandei and Melisandre. Oh, I'm a terrible person, and
goodness.
I apologize.
I thought I caught it, but I guess I didn't. That's my bad.
Well, I generally mix up the name, so there's proof that I was not lying. And second, Lauren and I will be at Atlanta Food and Wine this year.
Kind of, sort of, mostly. Mostly Annie, perhaps.
Yes.
I'm going to try to make it. I guess third low-key announcement, we're going to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we're going, like, soon.
Yeah. We're going to be there the 3rd through, like, the 14th of June.
Yeah.
And we're going to be working some of those days. And then Annie and I are both taking vacation time.
Yes.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't know either.
I look forward to it, though. So, yeah, we would love to hear any specific recommendations that y'all have for Hawaii. If you're going to be at the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival, please be on the lookout for us. We exist.
Yeah, we're not just like holograms or robots or anything. That would be ridiculous.
Vampires and sleeper agents, absolutely.
Yes, but not holograms.
Not holograms.
That is too far. But yeah, and also if you have any suggestions for Hawaii, send our way. And you can send those things to our email. It's hello@saverpod.com.
We are also on social media. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter @SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Andrew Howard and Dylan Fagan. Thanks to you for listening. And we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.